Again, I want to thank so many of you that this morning were helped make the Christmas concert, the Christmas cantata, God-honoring, Lord-honoring, God-glorifying worship service, from Pastor Jed to Libby with the children's choir to the accompanists, to those that were in the choir. So many of you were involved in that, and I do appreciate your hard work. Many, many hours of rehearsal went into that. So again, thank you. It was an encouragement to my soul and to the souls of many here. Isaiah chapter 65, we're going to go to the second half of Isaiah chapter 65. We're almost through this book of Isaiah. And so we have basically tonight and one more time in Isaiah, and we'll be finishing the book. You know, many people live as if there is no eternity. Or they talk that way. They'll say things like, you know, you live this life and then you die just like a dog and you don't exist anymore, just like an animal. You just go to the dirt. It's all, you're nothing. Your life's over. But the interesting thing is when you put those kinds of people in high-pressure situations, life-threatening situations, all right, the old saying used to be there are no atheists in foxholes, that when the shells are going off and the bullets are whizzing over your head, people who didn't know how to pray start praying. People who didn't believe in God start crying out to him. We saw the same thing in our country. Many of you are younger and may not remember this vividly, but September 11th, 2001, buildings came crashing down. And there were all of a sudden a great interest the next few weeks of people coming to church and trying to figure things out and reaching out to, you know, for prayer and these kinds of things. Well, why was that? Before that, God didn't matter. Some of those same people said, you know, I didn't think that, you know, there was a God, or I didn't really think about him and these kinds of things. They lived as if there was nothing after this life. There are many people who are practical atheists. If you ask them, is there a God? They say, oh, yes, you know, this world is too complicated for there not to be a God. But on the other hand, they live. And by this, I'm not using this hypothetically. I'm talking about the Old Testament tells us the fool hath said where? In his heart, there is no God. He's not outwardly saying there's no God. He's not denying that theoretically, but he's just in his heart. He's living like God doesn't exist. Like just life goes on and I don't need God in everyday life. And so what we have is, in this passage, a look to the future, to something beyond this life, to something beyond this time. I remember when I was a boy in a church I grew up in, that I remember hearing there was one man that used to say, you know, some people, and he said this quite frequently, some people are so heavenly minded, they're no earthly good. I don't know if you ever heard that expression. As a pastor, I've not met any of those people personally. Now, if you mean by that the guy who, you know, it's time to clean up the chairs after the fifth Sunday fellowship, and you say, hey, give us a hand, and he says, I'll sit over here and pray for you, instead of picking up chairs, then if that's what you mean, then I understand, okay? In other words, this is not, it's great to pray, but you can pray and lift chairs at the same time. That you're capable of doing both. So in other words, if you use a spiritual thing as an excuse to get out of doing something, then that would be a different story. But the idea that, you know, this person thinks about God and worships God so frequently that they're no practical use, what I found is the more godly somebody is, the more helpful they are. Generally, that's been my experience. And that my experience as a pastor, whether it's in my own life or in the lives of people that I know, Christians that I've known over decades, is that most people aren't heavenly minded enough. We're not struggling with people who are too heavenly minded, that are thinking about the things of God too frequently and therefore, you know, can't drive a car or something like that. No, what we struggle with is that we get very much bogged down in the now and now, the here and now, and we don't think about eternity. And so in this passage, our eyes are directed toward eternity in this beautiful description of a new heaven and a new earth. Now, why does the prophet Isaiah start to point to this? Because what we find here is a description that we've had in the second part of chapter 65, where he says, verse 9, for example, I will bring forth a seed out of Jacob and out of Judah, an inheritor of my mountains, etc. Verse 14, behold, my servant shall sing for joy of heart. But then he says those who are going to be judged will be sorrow of heart. And ye shall leave your name for a curse unto my chosen. For the Lord God shall slay thee and call his servant by another name. So when is this time going to come that God's going to judge and that he's also going to reward his servants. When is this going to happen? All right, because the fact is that we haven't really seen it happen yet, have we? Okay, now, I can recognize this, that you can be a believer in Jesus Christ, and we can have disagreements about the end times. Okay, so there are godly people through history who didn't view the end times the same way I do. So, for example, someone like Martin Luther, I think he was a believer. Okay, I mean, we may not be Lutherans, but I think he, you know, preached the gospel. But he believed that there was no literal thousand-year reign of Jesus on the earth. He was amillennial. I think that's wrong, but I think he was a believer. Do you follow what I'm saying? In other words, you don't have to believe in a premillennial return of Christ to be saved, is my point. But one of the things, and I personally believe that there's going to be a time that Jesus is going to return, and he's going to set up a literal kingdom on this earth. And that he's going to reign for 1,000 years, and that at the end of that reign, eventually, Satan will rebel, and Christ will put down that rebellion, and then God will make a new heaven and a new earth. I think that's consistent with what the scriptures teach. Now, I recognize I can be charitable about that and recognize, for example, Charles Spurgeon, the great Baptist pastor, did not believe in premillennialism. He was an amillennialist. But the fact is that when I look at these kinds of passages and these future promises, what I find is that I'm not finding passages that are saying, you know, God's kingdom is right now. Or I'm not finding passages that are saying right here and now is when God is accomplishing all of this. What I find is that God is giving us a promise to look forward to. I don't think necessarily this chapter in Isaiah is premillennial, but my point is, in saying this, is that we're looking forward to something. As, by that I don't think it excludes premillennialism, but I don't think it's the millennium that's primarily in view here. It's a new heaven and a new earth. But what we're looking forward to is, as the book of Hebrews would say, a city that has foundations whose builder and maker is God. Does that make sense? In other words, we're living for another time in another place, in a sense. That many of the things you do as a Christian, you're not doing because of this life. That, you know, if all you have is this life, why are you here? You should be at the beach or the golf course or Walt Disney World or something. Because you know, you eat, you sleep, you go to work, you play, and then it's all over. So why waste your time here? I'm not saying that that's true, that's how you should live, but my point is, if this is all there is, then it doesn't make sense. You might find some value in church, but the fact is, the reason we're here is because we believe that there's a time coming in eternity that God is going to reward and judge. Okay? And that because that's real, he's worthy of worship, he's worthy of rejoicing in, and I'm not living just for here and now. I'm living for another time in another place, verse 17. For behold, I create a new heaven and a new earth, and the former shall not be remembered nor come into mind. So what do we see? There's a time coming when God is going to make a new heaven and a new earth. All right? Now why? Because the current one that we're in is impacted by sin. That ever since the fall in the garden, the whole creation groans under the curse. We know that the curse of sin impacted more than just the people who sinned, right? It impacted them, Adam and Eve. It impacted their offspring. It impacted in the sense of death and then the curse of sin on all of us. But it also impacted the creation. And that is that there's thorns and thistles and those kinds of things that are part of the curse. That the earth doesn't bear the fruit it could have borne before the fall. That before that, Adam worked in the garden. Do note this, that in the Genesis account, work existed before the fall. Work is a good thing that's done to the glory of God. Because what does God do? He works for 6 days and then he rests. So what we have is a pattern of work and rest, and God has given us that pattern. That is a good pattern. All right? We live in a culture that says work is bad, play is good. All right? And our sayings, you can learn some things about a culture by its proverbs. And America has proverbs. I mean, we think of other cultures having, you know, there may be an old Jewish proverb or an old Chinese proverb, an old, you know, African proverb or whatever. And we think about the proverbs of various cultures. But America has proverbs, too. We don't think of them that way. But we say things like, time flies when you're having fun, right? If you're at work, it's boring. The clock barely moves. But when you're having fun, and what does that tell? It communicates something. Our culture values fun then, right? I don't know, though. If you've ever worked and you have a deadline, time flies too. right? Whether it's fun or not, if you have a deadline, time's flying because you're like, I got to get this done. How is this clock moving so fast? But what we do is we value fun. But what we find is that God created, He created the original heaven and earth. And then we find that He makes and creates man in His image, Adam and Eve, and that they are creators. And we're made in God's image and we can create. But what happened is we rebelled. Our first parents rebelled and we have joined in their rebellion and they plunged the universe into sin. So the heaven and the earth are impacted by it. I'm not sure exactly what this looked like. We could be hypothetical about this and say, you know, what does it mean? There was no death in the garden. I think it means human beings didn't die. I know that for sure. I'm not sure that doesn't mean leaves didn't ever fall from trees or something like that, if you follow what I'm saying. In other words, I'm not sure how long they were there, but I don't think it precludes autumn or something like that. But, you know, the tree didn't die. The leaves came off. I don't think that means that some of the skin cells on Adam and Eve didn't shed or something like that. I don't know. We just would be guessing at that. But the fact was, there was no death as we know it today. And so this was a perfect place, but because of sin, it was marred. And so there's a need for a recreation. And think about this, though, how glorious this is, because this fallen creation can be pretty magnificent at times. Stand on the rim of the Grand Canyon, or at the edge of Niagara Falls, or honestly, you go over to the Treasure Coast, over on the coast, and you know, or really pretty much most of the Gulf Coast of Florida, and watch the sunset on the Gulf, and it's pretty magnificent. Or the sunrise over on the Atlantic, it's pretty magnificent. And that's a fallen heaven and earth. Okay, so we can see there's still, the heavens still declare the glory of God, but God is remaking. There's going to be a time when He makes a new heaven and earth, and the former shall not be remembered nor come into mind. In other words, this one is going to be so good that the last one won't be memorable. All right, that this is going to outdo, and that all of the bad that was in that other one, this one will be so good that it will cause you to forget that. But be ye glad and rejoice forever in that which I create. For behold, I create Jerusalem a rejoicing and her people a joy. So here's what the Lord says. I'm going to make a new heaven and a new earth. And when I make this new heaven and new earth, I'm going to make Jerusalem the center of it. It's going to be the joy for people. And God's people, Israel, will be a joy. There'll be a rejoicing and a joy. And this is exactly what we find described, for example, in the book of Revelation. If you turn with me over to the book of Revelation, you'll find this same concept there. Revelation 21, verse 1. And I saw a new heaven and a new earth, for the first heaven and the first earth were passed away, and there was no more sea. And I, John, saw the holy city, New Jerusalem, coming down from God out of heaven, prepared as a bride adorned for her husband. And so what do we see? We find that there's a new heaven and earth and that Jerusalem is central again. Verse 19, and I will rejoice in Jerusalem and joy in my people, and the voice of weeping shall be no more heard in her, nor the voice of crying. Now, that's quite different because there's been a lot of weeping and crying in Jerusalem over the years. Been a lot of times that city's been the midst of slaughters and destructions and all kinds of things. Over thousands and thousands of years, that's happened many, many times. Not to mention the everyday, yeah, those are the major things. I mean, Titus the Roman general destroying the city, or Nebuchadnezzar destroying the city, or the city being looted during the Crusades and all kinds of other things that have taken place in history. But think about the everyday weeping that we have in life. Okay, so my boys, they play in a concert band, and they were playing on Friday night in the concert band. And one of the things, though, is that, you know, you're there at the concert band and all these families attending it, but there was some crying. And it's not because the music was bad. It's because there were toddlers there. Right? They didn't get their way or whatever happens. You know, the things toddlers cry over. Some of them are the same thing adults cry over, but the things they cry over, and there are times that there's crying in life, and sometimes they're a lot more serious than toddler crying. Sometimes it's weeping because we lost a loved one, because we got terrible news, because we got a life-threatening diagnosis, whatever it might be. But you know what? What we see here is there's not going to be any more weeping. It won't be heard. No voice of crying. Think of a time. There's a time coming when no one will cry anymore. There will be nothing to cry about. See, the implication is the old heaven and earth have to be replaced because of sin. Death comes because of sin. The wages of sin is death. So death comes because of sin. And what we find is when there's no more sin and death has been defeated permanently, then there comes a time that there's no more crying. There's no more death. There's only joy in the Lord. This is impossible for us to imagine, isn't it? I mean, we can imagine it, but we're not doing it quite correctly. It's much like other things. I don't know if you've ever experienced something where something was told to you, this is what this is like, but unless you've seen it yourself, it's almost impossible to describe it to someone else. Some of the places that I described, Niagara Falls, Iguazu Falls in South America, the Grand Canyon, some of these kinds of things, unless you've actually seen that yourself, you can come back and tell somebody about it. You can even show them the pictures. But it's one thing to look at a frame like this, and it's another thing that everywhere you look is a vista. And it's just impossible to describe to somebody unless they've been there. And so there's a sense in this in which I can kind of imagine it. So probably most of us in this room have never been to Victoria Falls in Africa. Maybe somebody has, but most of us probably haven't. Somebody could describe it to us, but unless you're actually there, it's kind of hard to imagine. You can imagine it, but you don't imagine it exactly. And that's exactly the point here, that there is a new heaven and a new earth coming, and there's not going to be any weeping. I mean, I can't even imagine life without weeping. We all entered this world crying. I mean, we worry as parents if that baby doesn't start crying pretty quickly. It's kind of what we expect of them. Verse 20, there shall be no more since an infant of days, nor an old man that hath not filled his days. For the child shall die 100 years old, but the sinner being 100 years old shall be accursed. Now, what is this saying? There's not going to be shortened lives. There's no infant mortality. Now, to us today, infant mortality is a fairly rare thing. There are people in this room who've grieved the loss of a child, whether in miscarriage or in an infant mortality type situation where a child died young. But that was even more common in the Bible type days, in this Old Testament time. I remember talking to one of our missionaries to Africa, and he said one of the interesting things is that in the African you get outside the big cities in Africa, and he said every family in his church had lost a child. Not just a miscarriage, but at some point, it was a dangerous enough place that whether it was infection or snake bite or whatever else, that of your 5 or 6 kids, one of them is not going to make it to adulthood, almost certainly. Now, that's hard for us to fathom, that imagine every family in the church having a child die before they reach adulthood. We kind of expect, it's kind of the rare thing when that doesn't happen. But in this day, I mean, it was like 1 in 4 children that died in infancy. So when you think about this, every family had lost somebody. So to give a promise that, look, there's not going to be any more, and this is one of the hardest things for a family, to lose a child this way. And so what we find is this promise, look, there's not going to be shortened lives. There's not going to be shortened lives. There's not going to be children who die prematurely. And they shall build houses and inhabit them, and they shall plant vineyards and eat the fruit of them. Now, again, sometimes this happens that people do a whole bunch of work for something, and then for whatever reason, they're not able to enjoy it. Somebody works their whole life and puts money into a pension fund to find out that it's been embezzled. Somebody works and builds their dream house, and then they get word that it burned down. Someone works and saves up money for that dream vacation, and then they're in a car accident. I mean, I know situations. I had a young couple that was, this young man was in my youth group or in the school that I taught in years ago. And he and his wife they had just gotten married. It was literally their wedding day, and they were running late to get to the airport for their honeymoon. And they were T-boned in a car accident on the way to the airport. So they didn't go on the honeymoon. They went to the hospital. Now, he walked away from it, but she ended up with many, many fractures and had a closed head injury and all kinds of fractures and things. And she just never was the same. They never went on a honeymoon like they were expecting. Okay? Those are tragic kind of events. A well-known theologian years ago in the 1800s, there was a man named Benjamin Breckinridge Warfield who taught at Princeton Theological Seminary. Back before 1920, Princeton was Bible-believing. And he taught there, and he got married, and he and his wife went on their honeymoon to Europe. They went to Germany. While they were in Germany, she was hit by lightning. She was struck by lightning on their honeymoon. Came back to the United States, and while they were in the United States for many years, he wasn't able to do anything other than go to class and teach and then come back to his home and care for his wife because she was an invalid from the lightning strike. I have a friend who is a pastor who years ago was struck by lightning and had one half of his diaphragm was paralyzed and all kinds of things. It completely changed his life because of the impact of the lightning strike. So she had these kind of impacts. And so their marriage was never the typical, you know, we expect you get married, you go on the honeymoon, you have that first year in that honeymoon period, and you know, then children come along and you have the joys of children and then watching them grow into adulthood and all of that that we normally expect in the normal process of life. But they didn't have that. And the interesting thing is that throughout this whole process, this man was faithful and would go home every day. Many of his colleagues would take preaching opportunities. They were well-known seminary professors, and they'd be asked to take a train to somewhere else in the country to go preach a Bible conference. And Benjamin Warfield couldn't take those because he had to care for his wife. The interesting thing is, in God's providence, he had Dr. Warfield write during that time, because the one thing he could do was sit home and write books. And he wrote a book, it's been a very, very valuable and helpful book, called The Inspiration and Authority of the Bible. If you've never read that book and you want to read about the scriptures and the doctrine of the Bible, it is a really good book. It's well over 100 years old, but it's a very good book, still a kind of a classic on that subject. And the Lord providentially worked through all that. But many times people have these kinds of situations where life doesn't go the way we expect. But guess what? In the new heaven and the new earth, there's no cut short honeymoons. There's no working your whole life for something to find it embezzled. You're not going to plant a vineyard so other people can eat the fruit of it. I was a college student, and I would, especially, so this is how it works. Some of you are college students or about to be college students. When you first go off to college, sometimes what happens is family members think, oh, we miss them. They're away at college. And they'll send you a care package. And it's nice to get a care package. Now, my parents were still very good at sending care packages, but like extended family, the first year I got care packages from an aunt or uncle, but then later those stopped coming. And I don't expect them from them, but that's, you know, at first it's all like everybody's excited you're off at college. And then later it's like, yeah, he's off at college. This is 3 years later. Get over it. But I got a care package my freshman year, and it had health food, spelled O-R-E-O in it. But it was one of those pound and a half Oreo things, you know, which to an 18-year-old college student, this was like gold, because the dining hall food was fine. It wasn't bad, but they didn't have Oreos. Dessert was Jell-O or something like that a lot of times. So had, you know, a pound and a half of Oreos. Well, I got this care package, I opened it up, and then I came down with the flu. And I had to check into the infirmary. And I came back to my room a few days later when I was feeling better, and my roommates had eaten all but two of those Oreos. And I came back and I said, where are my Oreos? They said, well, we saved you a couple. They said, we opened them and thought you wouldn't mind because you've always shared things before. But then as we started to eat, we realized we'd eaten more of them than we thought, and we thought we should leave you some. So I got two of the pound and a half of Oreos. So, not that I had worked for them, but they were from my family, and I didn't really get to enjoy them. Guess what? In the fallen heaven and earth, there may not be Oreos. But if there are, in the future, in the new heaven and new earth, not the fallen heaven and earth, but the new heaven and earth, no one will eat your Oreos. Okay? Just so you know. They shall not labor in vain, nor bring forth for trouble, for they are the seed of the blessed of the Lord, and their offspring with them. What do we see here? Here's a promise that God's people, that's us, that's God's people of Israel in the Old Testament, that we're going to enjoy this new heaven and new earth because we're God's people, we're God's, and we're not going to have this laboring in vain, like working for a vineyard and not enjoying the fruit of it. And it shall come to pass that before they call, I will answer. And while they're yet speaking, I will hear. That God says, I'll know what they need before they even ask. Now, that's certainly true of us today, right? But in a fallen world, we know the difficulties, and sometimes we struggle with the faith to understand that God answers our prayers. Because sometimes He answers them in our fallen state. We don't understand why God doesn't give us some of the things we want. Even the same good sometimes. But that in the new heaven and new earth, you don't even have to finish the prayer and God answers it. Not because He's slow to answer prayers today, but it will be so evident that requests to God will be answered. The wolf and the lamb shall feed together, and the lion shall eat straw with like the bullock, and the dust shall be the serpent's meat. Now, what do we see here? The wolf and the lamb shall feed together. Now, you often hear the lion's going to lie down with the lamb. That in scriptures don't ever say those words. But what it does say is that the wolf and the lamb are going to eat together. Now, normally, that doesn't happen. Okay? Usually the wolf eats the lamb, not that they eat together. You don't put out feed. Say, did you go feed the sheep today? Yeah, don't forget the wolves. If you're saying don't forget the wolves, what you mean is grab the gun to keep the wolves away. You don't mean go feed the wolves. You know, I've got a flock of sheep and a flock of wolves. No, that's not how we think of it. What we find here, though, is there's this reverse of the curse. That the death that comes from carnivores eating other animals and these kinds of things, what we find is that's gone. And the lion shall eat straw like the bullock. That's not what lions eat today. All right, if you're a zookeeper and you're feeding straw to the lion, you're going to get fired. Because he won't eat that. What does he want? He wants a good cut of meat. Okay? You've seen this. You've probably been to zoos or you go to Gatorland. You know, what do alligators eat? Not Cheerios. Okay, they want meat. Throw a big chunk of meat in and they go after it. They're carnivores. But there's going to be a time. That's what this is saying. I think what this is saying is that since there's not going to be any more death, that means lions aren't tracking down gazelles and tearing them apart. That God's going to change their nature. And dust shall be the serpent's meat. Now, this is interesting because what does this tell us? That curse on the serpent isn't reversed. Right? Well, it was the curse. That you're going to crawl on your belly and eat dust. That's what Genesis says. But that's still going to be the case. Why? Because Satan's still going to be cursed. And the object lesson of that snakes now crawl around in their belly will stay the same to remind us that Satan is defeated. So God doesn't give up all. He doesn't make it perfect at the expense of teaching what's theologically true, that Satan's been defeated. See, that's a wonderful thing here. Notice what it's saying is, yes, God's going to do away with death, but Satan will still be defeated. The tempter, he'll be defeated. The enemy, he'll be defeated. That's a wonderful truth. Satan's a great enemy of ours. In our society, which is very technologically and scientifically oriented. I mean, basically, in our society, if you say a scientist said it, people take it as true. But the fact is that there's lots of things scientists say that have nothing to do with science. Okay? They make pronouncements on things that have nothing to do with science. Now, I have no disregard for science. Wonderful things have happened through scientific discoveries. Okay? Cures to diseases, technological. You know, we all came here in things that are based on scientific discoveries. Cars, things like that. So it's not to denigrate science. But what it is to say is that just because if a scientist gets up and says, you know, there's no scientific proof that whatever, and they're just pronouncing on things, that's not science, that's scientism. That's a belief in the scientist, just because he's a scientist. And what happens is that, you know, we just give a lot of credence to those things. And that's fine, but, you know, science has to be held to its old standards. What can it test? What can it prove? What can it do? What can it disprove, etc.? And scientists know full well that you can't prove a universal negative. There are no such thing as anywhere in the universe. Have you been there? And so what happens is that because of that, what happens is that we almost as American Christians forget that Satan exists. Because you can't really go find him scientifically. Where is he? Is he under this poinsettia? I'm not mocking. I'm just saying, you see what my point is? You can't pick the poinsettias up and look for him. It's not going to work that way. He's a spirit being, a fallen angel, and he doesn't work in the same realm we do, in the same way we do. And he's not testable, like scientifically. And so the fact is that we tend to then say, since we can't measure him like we can so many other things in our natural world, he's not real. And I'm not saying most Christians say that, but we almost forget that he is real. Now, don't misunderstand me. The Bible is very clear that we do not have a dualism. Okay, there are other religious systems in the world that have a dualism. The good God and the bad God. Okay, Satan is not a God. He's a creation. He's not equal to God. God's not worried about Satan in the sense that, oh no, Satan might be more powerful than me. No, God's not worried about that. So we don't have a dualism, but the fact is that he is real and he does terrible things. And he's plotting your destruction. And it's hard for us to remember that because he makes your destruction look pretty good sometimes. The same way, I'm not a real good fisherman. I enjoy fishing at times. I have to be honest, I enjoy catching. Okay? If I'm fishing and don't catch anything, I don't enjoy it quite as much. Still, it can be nice out and you can have a nice day out on the boat. And it's still a lot better if you catch something. But what do? To catch some fish? You don't say, you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to put something that looks like a giant predatory fish in the water and try to catch fish. No, they'll be like, get away. What do? I put something in there that looks like food. And they say, yummy. And they come after it, and they bite it. Now, it could be something shiny, because some fish are shiny, or it just catches their attention. But you have a hook on it, right? You don't want them to see the hook. You want them to see the lure or the bait. Why? Because they think that looks good, until they get the hook in them. So I remember fishing one time with a friend of mine over in the Clearwater area. And we were fishing for redfish in the flats, and we were casting in, but we got into a bunch of sail cats. So it's a catfish. It's a saltwater catfish. And they're nasty. Maybe you like them. I don't know. I don't know anybody that eats them. And then they have those catfish barbs that'll sting you. And the other fun thing with the sail cats is they kept swallowing the hook. Other fish sort of bite the hook and it gets caught in their lip or in their mouth somewhere. They had it all the way down in them. And so, you're trying to rescue the hook because you'd like to reuse it. And you got this nasty fish caught in there that you don't want to keep, but you want to throw it back. And you're just frustrated by these fish. Now, I'm trying to catch a redfish because I want to take that and eat it. But what am I trying to do? I'm trying to put bait out there. And if you get the right bait and you get the right situation, you can catch that fish. But what do? You end up killing him if you eat him. Right? And that's what Satan's trying to do to you. He's holding out lures saying, look at this. Doesn't this look good? And you're like, yes. And then he's like, I gotcha. And he kills you with it. Destroys you with it. We forget that. That's what he's doing in people's lives spiritually. So it's good. If you were a fish, you'd want the fisherman gone. Right? And what happens is that he is trying to destroy us. And so the fact that he is going to be permanently defeated is a wonderful truth. I think this year, a madman named Charles Manson died. I think earlier in the year. Many of our young people may not know who Charles Manson is. You don't necessarily need to know. But in the late 1960s, he led a kind of a crazy group of people that were into drugs and things to murder people. But I remember back in the 1980s, I think it was, they had an interview with him. He'd come up for parole once in a while. And I forget who the interviewer was, but this person sat down in an interview with him, and they were talking to Charles Manson, and they said, so you're coming up for parole. What will you do if you get out? And Charles Manson said, I'll kill more pigs. That was what he called the people that he killed. That's not a good way to have an interview before the parole board, but I'm glad he said that on film so they could show it to them. I'll kill more pigs. And then he looked at the interviewer and he said, I'd kill you right now if there weren't men with guns standing right here. All right. Is that a guy you want out of prison? No. He's not a safe person. Satan's a far worse enemy than that. As scary as that man might have been, as crazy as he might have been, Satan's worse. The difference is Satan doesn't look crazy. Satan's sly. He's subtle. He's a destroyer. And what this passage says is he's going to be permanently defeated. The worst enemy you've ever had that this universe has ever had is going to be permanently defeated. That's the new heaven and the new earth. The Lord says, they shall not hurt nor destroy in my holy mountains, saith the Lord. It's not going to be wars. It's not going to be destructions. There's not going to be hurt. I think the implications of this are not going to be hurricanes. Hurricanes may be a little adventurous at times. You know, Hurricane Irma came through. But I don't know about you. It gets a little old boarding up the windows. Hoping that the roof stays on. Those kinds of things. Some of our young people are like, are you kidding? We have hurricane parties. It means we get Twinkies and ice cream. And you do get to do that, right? So the electricity goes off. You got to eat the stuff in the freezer. It means the steaks are coming out and getting grilled the next day. Ice cream's coming out. So I understand the fun of that. But the fact is that a bad hurricane's a bad thing. A bad tornado's a bad thing. A bad flood's a bad thing. A wildfire's a bad thing. An earthquake's a bad thing. The implication of this verse seems to be that there's not going to be any of that. There's not going to be war anymore. Now, during war, there is some valor and there's some heroism and some courage that we see in people. But that's despite the war. All right? Just about anybody I've ever known that served in war would say, you don't want to be in one. You don't want to be in one. In fact, I knew a man years ago that was bragging about what he did during the Vietnam War. And I started to get skeptical because I knew some men who served in both World War II and Vietnam, and they never bragged about it. They usually didn't want to talk about it. And then it came out later that he was making it all up. He was in Vietnam, but he didn't do all the things he claimed he had done. Because war is a horrible thing. It's much better to have peace than war. Now, people might do, like I said, courageous things, and there might be great heroism in war, but the fact is that getting shot at, getting stabbed, getting attacked, having people who want to kill you is bad. The death and destruction that comes from it is bad. I appreciate the sacrifice that the crosses at Arlington National Cemetery represent, or at the National Cemetery in Bushnell. I appreciate what those markers represent, but the fact is, every one of those families would rather have that person back than killed in war. And so there's not going to be any more war. There's not going to be more destruction. This is all going to be reversed. Now, is this a time worth living for? You see, this is the choice we're faced with as Christians is, are we going to be people who live for another time in another place? For City U.S. Foundations whose builder and maker is God? Or are we going to be people who say, you know, this is really all that matters. Don't get too serious about eternity because, you know, that you're just taking that too seriously. No. In fact, what we find is that when we take this seriously, that we're actually looking forward to this, it changes the way we approach this life. And for the better. That a person who's saying, someday I have to answer to God, that someday those who trust in Christ, they're going to be rewarded. That person tells others about Christ. That person shows love to other people. That person, we see the Spirit changes them. And so again, we need to have a perspective that says, I'm living for another time in another place. For a city that has foundations whose builder and maker is God. That there's going to be a time that there's going to be a new heaven, a new earth. God's going to remake everything. See, all the frustrations we have about injustices and death and all the weeping and everything that comes in this life, eventually there's going to be no more of that. There's just going to be rejoicing in the presence of the Lord. In a new, wonderful new heaven. And new earth. This is a wonderful promise. It's a wonderful thing to look forward to. You see, because what happens is, as our culture has moved more toward rejecting this, we've moved more toward despair. Okay, because at a certain point, if none of this is true, if God's not going to do this, if there is no God, or if however you look at it, whatever the answers people give, what it leads to is despair. Where's their meaning? I mean, you know, the answer tends to be either kind of a hedonism that says, well, who knows what happens next, so I'm just going to get drunk and have fun and do all these kinds of things and because I'll be dead soon. Or the other answer that people have is that they tend to go into despair and say, you know, I'm so sophisticated, but yet life has no meaning and I'm depressed. And there's a despair there. But the Lord is calling us to a rejoicing because there is something to look forward to. That when this life is hard, remember, this isn't all there is. There's a time coming. That this is part of the basis of our comfort. And you all know this, you've seen this. What's the difference between the funeral of a person who knew the Lord and we have confidence that they're in His presence and a person who's an unbeliever and a lot of the family's an unbeliever? There's a huge difference in those funerals. Isn't there? I mean, people who go to a believer's funeral for the first time and they see it, they go, this was really different. I've never seen people have that attitude at a funeral. Because it's not all over. It's not the end of everything. There's hope. That's why we, as the scriptures say, we don't sorrow as those who have no hope. We have a hope of an eternity. And so there's great practicality to this. There is a time coming. We're living for this time, for the time when God remakes everything. We can rejoice in His presence. And it means that all of the things that we struggle through in this life are only temporary. And there's a time coming when we'll rejoice in a new heaven and a new earth and in the presence of our Savior. Let's bow our heads.